We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the summer of 1965, Lyndon Johnson gave what many people considered the most important civil rights speech of his presidency. Certainly, he thought so. This took place in June at Howard University. It was the commencement address. And in this speech, President Johnson talked about the end of the first stage of the civil rights movement, which he said was the effort to secure legal equality for African Americans. He said now was the time for the second stage, not just freedom, he said, but opportunity. And near the end of this speech, he talked about the breakdown of the black family, something that he said white America must accept responsibility for. And he said, unless we work to strengthen the family, everything else that we could do will never be enough to, quote, cut completely the circle of despair and deprivation. This was a speech that was based in part on a report on the state of the black family that was written by then Assistant Secretary of Labor Daniel Patrick Moynihan. It was something that was never intended for public release, but it did become public and proved quite controversial, and is seen that way by many people to this day. In this hour of Focus, we'll talk with historian James Patterson. He is emeritus professor at Brown University, and he's the author of the book Freedom Is Not Enough, The Moynihan Report, and America's Struggle Over Black Family Life from LBJ to Obama. It was published last year by Basic Books, and we're pleased to have him joining us this morning to talk. Questions are welcome. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also send us questions by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. And Professor Patterson, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you for talking with us.
That was a very nice and accurate introduction. Thank you.
Well, you know, I think as Mr. Moynihan at the time was in the Labor Department, I suppose that on the face of it, some people might think it was odd, unusual, unexpected that somebody in labor would be thinking about family issues. But I think that the important point here that you make is that Mr. Moynihan thought what was going on with the black family was something that was at heart an economic issue, that the causes were economic and that the solutions would be economic.
Yes, that's true. It was his report, which was 78 pages long, printed in the basement of the Labor Department, as you say, not intended for public consumption, but aimed at reaching high-ranking people in the government, which it ultimately did because, as you say, it served as the basis for President Johnson's speech at Howard University. In June, Moynihan finished his report in late March and was lobbying incessantly Bill Moyers and various other people that he knew in the White House circle to get Johnson to take note of it. We don't know if he actually read it, but he heard of it, and that's why he gave the speech. But Moynihan had an interest in this for a number of reasons. First of all, although it's hard to trace this because he never talked much about it, he himself was abandoned, as were his two younger siblings, by his own father, who was a drunk and left him, and he never saw his father again, although his father lived for many years thereafter in California most of the time. So he went through some hard times in New York City, which is where he was living when his father abandoned him and was at one point shining shoes in near Times Square and so forth and so on. So he knew what it was like to grow up in a fatherless family. On top of that, he was a Democratic liberal, a huge fan of his President Kennedy. They were both Irish Catholics, and Moynihan was very proud of Kennedy. It was Kennedy who first appointed him to the Labor Department. And when Kennedy was assassinated, he stayed on under Lyndon Johnson and increasingly became interested in family issues and civil rights issues. And when the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed in the summer, Moynihan was, I think, well ahead of his time, really. recognize that, as you pointed out in your introduction, that the Civil Rights Act was a powerful piece of legislation. Indeed, it was. In a relatively short period of time, it wiped out most of the vestiges of segregation, mandated Southern-style segregation. But he realized that once blacks had these civic rights and civic equality, and they were going to get more of it when the Voting Rights Act, which was going through Congress in early 65, was passed, as it ultimately was that summer of 65, that they would also have voting rights. But what they really needed was social and economic justice. And this is what Johnson's speech was all about, and this was what Moynihan's report was doing as it bombarded the reader with statistics, charts, and graphs. I don't know if you've seen the report itself. They're hard to find. It's on the web, but it's full of scary-looking graphs and charts about the extent of illegitimacy, as it was called then, or what we now would call non-marital pregnancies, which were eight times as high in terms of percentages among blacks as among whites, with the data he had for late 1963. At that time, the percentage for black children born out of wedlock was 23.6. And by the time he actually wrote the report in 65, it was 25. So one quarter of black births were out of wedlock, as compared to roughly 3% among whites. So it was a multiple of eight. And in the central cities, it was much higher than that. So this was the problem he was concerned with. He thought that it was going to get worse. We could talk about this later, but I don't think he had any idea how much worse it was going to get, because it really, those numbers went skyrocketing in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
But that was that's where he got his interest from. Just one more point. He wrote a report also as an assistant secretary of labor. He had a fair amount of freedom to do this kind of individualized research, which is relatively rare in those days. Usually you just, you know, sat at your desk and did your chores. But Moynihan was a very smart man. He was well-read. He was a scholar of sorts. He had a Ph.D. from the Fletcher School of Diplomacy on the International Labor Organization. He was never what you would call an original scholar, although he taught off and on at Harvard for a number of years. But he was very well read, and he was very quick and very smart, and he knew a lot about social programs in Europe, where he'd studied at the London School of Economics for a year in the 50s. And he wrote this report in 1964 called One Third of a Nation. Again, an internal labor report, although it was reported on in the press. This took off from FDR's famous speech in 1937 about one-third of the nation being ill-clad, ill-nourished, ill-something. I can't remember the exact quote. But he said that one-third of the young people were unable to pass the physical and what he called the mental, which was basically an IQ test or an achievement test, to get into the armed services. And while this wasn't new information to people who knew about the poor mental and physical health of many poor Americans, it was a bit of a shocker when it hit the press. So, and he pointed out clearly that the people who were least likely to pass these tests were people from low income and large families. And so he went from there to write the actual Moynihan report, which was titled
The Negro Family Case for National Action.
Negro Family, The Case for National Action.
Mm.
And the subtitle made clear that he did think that there should be national action to help black families, and if you helped black families, many other things would get better for the poor who live particularly in the cities.
Mm.
He was very clear in the report to make it clear that he wasn't talking about all black people. He was aware that there was an emerging middle class among blacks, although it was small. But he was talking about the lower classes, again, a phrase that he used, that we don't use anymore. Like we don't use a lot of phrases like illegitimacy or lower class or whatever, but we don't use Negro, but he used that because everybody else did. So was the Negro family the case for national action, and that was the report.
You know,
I'm sorry,
I've gone
on at great length.
No,
give your listeners some background.
That's excellent, and I think just to make a further point, you know, that we'll talk, I'm sure, some more about the reaction to the report once it became public. But clearly what happened was that Mr. Moynihan was widely attacked. He was accused of being a racist. And going back to this speech, this Johnson speech of 1965 at Howard, certainly that speech, which was co-written by Mr. Moynihan, acknowledged the problem of racism very clearly. And as I'd said, and that was I was reading from the speech that the president said, talked about the breakdown in the black family. He said, for this, most of all, white America must accept responsibility. So this speech, which was co-authored by Moynihan, certainly didn't dodge the issue of racism.
No, it didn't. He talked about 3 centuries of unimaginable exploitation. I think that's a quote. And he also talked about a racist virus in the American bloodstream. He had a talent for phrases and dramatic turns of words, which are memorable, but what also got him in trouble. And the one that got him in most trouble, and we're getting ahead of ourselves, actually, because this what you're talking about comes a little bit later, was when he said that when you put all the information together about what was troubling these lower-class black families, I mean, high dropout rates, alienation, a little bit about drugs, but not much. It wasn't a huge problem then. The irrelevance for most of these kids of churches and of religious upbringing, their huge problems in schools, and of course, the low income that they had in the bad neighborhoods they lived in and the crime that was surrounding them. So it was, in one sense, an ecological and certainly an environmental explanation, not a genetic one and certainly not a white racist one. But he did conclude by saying that what all this added up to was the most famous phrase in the report and actually a chapter title. There were small chapter headings in this report, a tangle of pathology. And pathology, of course, is a pretty harsh word. It means disease. A tangle is a pretty tough word. It's a memorable phrase. He actually took it from the writings of a black activist named Kenneth Clark, who at the same time wrote a book called Dark Ghetto, which was about Harlem. Clark, in fact, was famous for his experiments back in the early 50s with showing young black children dolls, D-O-L-L-S, dolls, and finding out that many of the black children preferred playing with white dolls instead of black dolls. And from that, I concluded, he was a psychologist, as was his wife, that racism had so damaged the black psyche, if you want, that they were ashamed of their own color and liked to play with white dolls. And Chief Justice Earl Warren picked up on this, as did the Supreme Court in the Brown versus Board of Education case, which, by the way, I've written a book about called Brown versus Board of Education, mm-hmm. way back in 1954. And so Clark had a long experience in writing about and racial issues and studying black people as a psychologist. His data, by the way, about these doll studies wasn't any good. That's another point. He was certainly well known, and in this book, Dark Ghetto, he talked about pathology a lot, as in many papers and research reports that he had made prior to publication of the book about the Harlem organization that he ran with his wife in the early 60s. So this was a phrase that a black person had used at great length, and nobody paid much attention to it. When a white Irish guy like Moynihan was known to have used it when the report was leaked and became known later in the summer, It made him seem, in the eyes of some people, to be not only unflattering to black people, but perhaps something of a racist. Hmm.
Let me take the opportunity here to introduce once again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in. We're talking with James Patterson. He is Ford Foundation Professor of History Emeritus at Brown University. His books include one he just mentioned. It's a book about the Brown v. Board of Education case. He's also written Restless Giant, The United States from Watergate to Bush v. Gore. And the new book, which is Freedom is Not Enough, The Moynihan Report and America's Struggle Over Black Family Life from LBJ to Obama. And that book is published by Basic Books. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455.
Should have mentioned, yes. You did, that the title Freedom is Not Enough is a phrase taken from Johnson's speech.
From that 1965 Howard
and
University
also
speech.
From Moynihan's writing of the speech. Actually, I don't want to get Richard Goodwin upset, but the ideas were all Moynihan's. I've been in his papers, which is the largest single collection of personal papers in the Library of Congress. He saved everything, and they're very rich with documents and letters and so forth that he wrote over the years, and drafts of speeches and so forth. And you can clearly tell that as early as January of 1965, he was talking about freedom is not enough.
As we've explained, that this report was not intended for public release. It was intended as an internal government document to be the basis for a conversation to get people talking about the problem and how to respond. It didn't even have Mr. Moynihan's name on it. But it did some months after it was created. First of all, there were apparently among the chattering classes in Washington, there were stories circulating about the fact that the report existed and it was potentially very explosive. And then apparently some sections of the report were leaked to the press. And then finally it came to the point where the government actually made copies available to people who wanted to have them. Maybe you can talk a little bit about how it is that it went from being this thing intended to be not for public distribution and how it got leaked and why.
Well, you've obviously read my book and you know that I don't know who leaked it. Some people said that it was leaked by Bill Moyers, who became Johnson's chief aide that summer and was also press secretary, although there's no particular reason to know why he would have done that. A lot of people think that Moynihan himself leaked it. There's no proof of that, although I'm inclined to believe that's how it got out. What happened was that Moynihan, as we know, wrote the report, finished it in late March, was circulating a memoranda and a copy of the speech, of the report, to people in the administration. But then Moynihan, left the Department of Labor in July of 1965 in order to run as a Democrat on a Democratic primary ticket for the head of the he would have been the head of the city council of New York, number two man from the mayor. By the way, he ultimately lost that primary, and the Democrats lost, and of all people, John Lindsay, Republican, took over as mayor of New York in November of 1965. But Moynihan was no longer in the government. However, he was running for office, and he had a tough race, which he ultimately lost, and some people think, well, he would release this report to show what a good liberal he was and how concerned he was with civil rights, and that's how it got out. I can't prove that. Nobody can, but it did, as you point out, gradually leak out. You put it very well. There are stories in Newsweek and various other places, and then a very key column by a couple of columns, Robert Novak.
It was Evans and Novak.
Roland Evans. R-O-W-L-A-N-D, Robert Novak and Roland Evans, well-known syndicated columnists, had a syndicated column in July, which was titled The Moynihan Report, at which point the report, which was called the Negro Family, the Case for National Action, became known as the Moynihan Report, even though, as you say, his name wasn't on it. So that's probably how it got leaked. But it got leaked, as you point out, in dribs and drabs and in snippets, and some of the information that came out was a little misleading. But what really hurt it, what hurt the cause, was the breakout as of August 11th, 1965, just as these first snippets were appearing of the terrific, terrible riot in Watts in Los Angeles, which lasted for 6 days and was shown round the clock by television coverage, a lot of from helicopters of burning and looting of Los Angeles. 34 people were killed. It was the first of the really terrible race riots of the late 60s. And it dramatically changed the whole nature of the way a lot of white people looked at black people. No longer were they long-suffering, Christ-like Southern blacks who had been trampled on by segregation. Now they were angry looters and rioters and burners and arsonists and troublemakers and dropouts and angry young men. This did a lot to drain public support from the civil rights movement. It did a lot to totally alienate, the riot did, Johnson, who was completely mystified that this could have happened. He kept saying, how could this be? After all, I've done for them. And he had done a lot with the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65 and his famous We Shall Overcome statement to the Congress earlier that year after the Selma trouble. But he could not control the irresistible urge of a lot of young black people to move beyond an interracial, nonviolent civil rights movement, to some extent dominated by white Washington politicians like Johnson and the Congress people who passed the legislation. There was an urge to take over their own movement and also to kick Whitey out of the most militant organizations, which they did by some early in 66. They basically threw all the whites, almost all the whites, out of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, and CORE, the Congress on Racial Equality. And shortly after that, you get the phenomenon of black power, and by then the whole interracial, nonviolent civil rights movement is in a shambles.
Hmm.
Watts had an awful lot to do with changing white attitudes towards blacks and also changing the attitude of civil rights leaders who suddenly realized, whoo, we really haven't paid enough attention to this side of things. We've been too focused on the South. And so they join up with the more militant, more black power oriented, all that phrase is not yet in vogue in 65, civil rights people. So the Watts riot is a moment of historic change in United States history. I'm now writing a book about 1965, so I'm very much aware of this. It happens just at the same time as Johnson has made a huge escalation in Vietnam a couple of weeks earlier. And those two things together just really tear holes in Johnson's liberal coalition, which had been so strong and was passing all this great society legislation, voting rights, Medicare, Medicaid, so forth, all of which passed in 65. And so this is what happened. When the report gets leaked, many people say, well, this is Moynihan's explanation for the riots. Well, that's ridiculous. Of course, he wrote the report before the riot occurred, although there had been riots in 64, smaller ones, notably in Harlem, and Moynihan was very aware of that. Also Philadelphia, Paterson, New Jersey, Rochester, New York, other places. Well, I'm going on too long.
I think a number of things...
We don't know who leaked it. Yeah. The leak definitely came out at a bad time for him.
And it's important here, as you say, to appreciate the fact that a number of things are coming together to impinge on the Johnson administration, this change in the tone and the issues in the civil rights movement, it comes at the same time when the president is increasingly preoccupied and his attention is drawn to the war in Vietnam. So all of those things together really leads to a moving away from, or let us say, a lowering of the priority of civil rights as issues that the administration wanted to tackle.
Yes, in fact, at the Howard speech, Johnson made what was interpreted as a promise to run to organize a large conference in the fall, which would get all kinds of experts together and deal with this problem. And the expectation was that this conference would come up with some good policy ideas, and that the government would then begin its efforts to actually pass legislation that might do something about these problems. That's another whole subject we could talk about, by the way. What do you do? But he backs away from that. And it's the Watts riots that really do this to him, because he just cannot understand why this is happening. When the first reports of Watts came to him, he was in his ranch in Texas, and for 4 days he refused to answer the phone or any of the cables that were coming in from Los Angeles that were pleading with him to authorize the sending of federal help to help the California National Guard stop all this rioting and so forth. So he wouldn't do it. He just couldn't believe it, and he was personally hurt and very self-pitying about this, because of all he had done. And so he basically drops the idea of having a major conference in November. And, of course, his increasing obsession with the needs in Vietnam, as you point out, is another issue, to say nothing of the funding necessary for Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And although he thought he could do both guns and butter, it didn't bother him. But, he drops the idea, and by late August, early September, it's clear that the only thing that's going to happen in 1965, it'll be a small planning conference, which did occur in a Washington hotel in November. But the issue of family problems was essentially almost entirely stricken from the agenda of the conference, and it accomplished nothing. And then when they finally had the so-called major conference in June of 66, almost a year to the day of his Howard speech in 65, it was a big PR thing, and nothing came of it. So, again, the Watts riot just is one of the many things that, and the most important thing, I think, which turns Johnson against following up on his Howard speech. And when he hears that a lot of blacks don't like the Moynihan Report because of the secondhand information they're getting from the press about phrases like tangled pathology, he doesn't want to touch the Moynihan Report either, and he drops that like a hot potato. Mm. He didn't like Moynihan much anyway, by the way, because Moynihan had supported Bobby Kennedy for the Senate in New York in 1964, and he was regarded as a Kennedy man, and Johnson hated Bobby Kennedy, and the feeling was mutual. And so anybody who was a big Bobby Kennedy supporter was not in Johnson's camp.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of focus is James Patterson. He is a Ford Foundation Professor of History Emeritus at Brown University. He's author of the books Restless Giant, which looks at the U.S. from Watergate to Bush v. Gore, also Brown v. Board of Education, a Civil Rights Milestone and Its Troubled Legacy, and the book that we're talking about here this morning, Freedom is Not Enough, The Moynihan Report, and America's Struggle Over Black Family Life from LBJ to Obama. That book is published by Basic Books. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We're on the web, and you can send us an email if you like. That's will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. The book is also, in part, about Mr. Moynihan. We mentioned the fact that after the report became public, that he was widely attacked. He was accused of being racist. Interestingly enough, though, this didn't affect his later political career. He was elected to the Senate from New York, and he was in the Senate from 1976 until 2000. He also served as U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Perhaps you can talk a little bit about how being associated with the what came to be called the Moynihan Report affected the political career of Mr. Moynihan.
Yes, that's a good question. I can't give you a very good answer. You're right. My book does try to feed. It's hard for me to do. I'm not sure I did it very well. To feed the subsequent career, post-65 career of Moynihan through the larger public debate, when and if it occurs. That's another story about black families. And in the course of it, I mentioned some of Moynihan's positions. You left one out, not because you don't know about it, but you didn't. What's really interesting is that after he loses his race for the city council in New York in late 65, he has a one-year position as in a think tank at Wesleyan College in Connecticut, and then gets a job as a professor of education at Harvard, and teaches at Harvard off and on from the fall of 1966 until he runs for the Senate in early 76. But between then, he also is, first of all, President Nixon's top domestic advisor in 1969 and 70, and then Nixon's ambassador to India from 1973 to 1975, and then, as you say, President Ford's ambassador to the United Nations before he runs as a Democrat in 1976 and wins the first of his 4 6-year terms before he retires in 2000 and is replaced by Hillary Clinton, and then Moynihan himself died in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
So I do try to feed this through. Moynihan continues to have an interest under Nixon. He works very hard to get through what's called a family assistance plan, which would have helped lower class black families and others. It passes the House, but never gets through the Senate. Very frustrating for him. Then he, as I say, does these other things. And the whole issue of black families is something that he shies away from to some considerable extent in the 70s because, as you said, it had become such a toxic subject.
Mm-hmm.
He is, as you say, blamed by some for being a racist because of the unflattering things he says about lower-class black families. The famous phrase that is used sometimes was the title of a book by William Ryan, a white Boston psychologist and a civil rights activist who published a book called Blaming the Victim in 1971. And that's a phrase we often hear about, and it really comes into vogue with that book as applied to Moynihan, that what Moynihan was doing was saying that blacks were the ones to blame for the bad situations they were in. This was, 1,000% inaccurate, but it was something that a lot of people on the civil rights left, especially black militants, but also many white liberals, either believed or didn't want to challenge. Because they, too, would have been regarded as racists, they thought, if they supported this report. And so for about 15 years at least, until the early 80s, it's a subject that is toxic, and neither Moynihan or anybody else much wants to talk about it. In the meantime, the problem gets much, much worse. So that by the late 80s, early 90s, I should say, roughly 68 to 70% of black babies are born out of wedlock, and that's close to three times the 25% that was the case in 1965. Whites, by the way, are undergoing also a big increase in their family situations. So today we have roughly 70% of plus of black babies born out of wedlock. And by the way, roughly 80% of first births by black women are out of wedlock in this country. And it's not all teenagers either. I won't bother you with statistics. But the white percentage is over 30 as opposed to 3 in 1965. So they've gone from 3 to 30. The blacks have gone from 25 to over 70. And the national average now, if you put the whites and the blacks together, is a little over 40%.
Mm.
So that roughly 4 out of 10 babies today are born out of wedlock. Well, these figures, as I say, escalated enormously over the period from 65 until the early 90s. They have the black figure has been fairly steady since the early 90s. The white figure keeps rising because it has further to go. And some of these statistics can be a little misleading. One of the reasons why these numbers are so high today is we have so much more people living together out of marriage. But these relationships are much less likely to last than marital ones. And so the numbers of children living in fatherless families is enormous, and most of them are poor, and it's a very horrible, desperate situation for most of these people. So I trace the changes within the black community, but leave Moynihan sort of out of all of that, except when he's trying to do something with Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
And then it picks up again in the mid and late 80s, by which time Moynihan has a little bit of seniority in the Senate. And he and various other people, notably William Julius Wilson, who wrote a famous book called The Truly Disadvantaged. He's a black sociologist now at Harvard, and this was written in 1987, in which Wilson, who's a liberal Democrat, or liberal at any rate, praises the Moynihan Report, says it was a structural thing, that he really wanted to do something about it, that the problems were economic, that he got a bad rap, and this helped revive, I wouldn't say the popularity of the Moynihan Report, but a closer look at it. And nowadays, I think it's generally recognized, certainly I'm a fan of the report, make no bones about that, as a very prescient and accurate statistic document, which deserves to be read.
We have just a moving in.
I do try to follow Moynihan through, and he takes an active opposing role in the so-called welfare reform of 1996, which President Clinton signed, which did away with the Aid to Families with Dependent Children program, AFDC, which had been established by the Social Security Act in the 30s, and which provided unmarried women with support for themselves and their children if they fell under a certain cash standard of living. And they replaced it with something that Moynihan didn't like. So, yes, I do follow this through and end up with Moynihan giving a speech in 2002, a year before his death.
We have a couple of callers and about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus with our guest, James Patterson. He's an emeritus professor of history at Brown University. We have two people here ready to go and want to try to get them in both, and we'll take them in the order they came in, starting with someone in Terre Haute, Indiana, line 4.
I'll try to be brief this time.
All right. We'll go here to Terre Haute, line 4. Hello.
Hello, Dr. Patterson. It's good hearing you talk on such an important subject and such an important individual in our public life.
By the way, I spent 8 years as an assistant professor at IU in Bloomington.
Oh, is that right? Well, I spent a number of years at Indiana State University teaching African American history, I might say.
Oh.
And I can remember the time well, although I came in after the report, and it long discussions and debates about the black family, and a lot of it was centered on differences between, let's say, E. Franklin Frazier and Stanley Elkins on the black family and Herbert Gutman and followers of Herbert Gutman.
Yes, that's all in my book.
Well, this is good because I think, and I'm sorry I haven't had a chance to read your book yet, but it seems to me that there was that this was a failing of the Moynihan Report, as I remembered, and it's hazy, I must say, that he relied too heavily historically on seeing like a fatal flaw in the black family coming out of slavery, and that almost this followed down and perhaps was reinforced by racism, segregation and racism in the modern era, but it made it easy for critics, both left and right, to point to the slave family as the failing, and this, of course, would allow people to just sort of wash their hands of the findings. What are we going to do with something that's, the seed is so deep and so so important? How did you respond to that, or
Right. There's a lot in the report, not a lot, there's a fair amount in the report about slavery. There are references to the book you mentioned by Stanley Elkins called Slavery, which appeared in 1959, which was a book, as you know, which essentially said that slavery was such an evil institution that it essentially infantilized the slaves and made them helpless, childlike creatures, basically without personalities or lives of their own. And this was regarded by some critics then, and most critics since, and by me, as a huge exaggeration. Slavery was an evil thing, but as many other people like Herbert Gutman, you mentioned, have pointed out, blacks nonetheless remain human beings, and in many cases were very, very, very purposeful and intelligent, hardworking, and so forth and so on, even though they had themselves been slaves or their parents and grandparents had been. But I don't think the Moynihan Report really should be seen as something which primarily blames the situation of blacks on a slavery which was so bad that subsequent generations could not do anything about it. He believed that each new generation of young black people grows up and unfortunately faces very similar kinds of discriminatory and economic injustice, and therefore suffers as their parents and grandparents had. But he made it clear it was absolutely not genetic, and he did not use phrases like intergenerational. There is not one mention of the word culture in that whole document. He did not believe this was a cultural phenomenon. 2 years earlier, Michael Harrington, of course, had written about a culture of poverty. He was a buddy of Moynihan's, a drinking buddy, and got away with it in part because he didn't racialize it. He talked about poverty as a general thing. But I think Moynihan's was essentially a structural report. There's a lot in there about the problems of what we later called deindustrialization, about the huge mass migrations, about the rotten schools that exist in these districts, and especially and above all else, they kept coming back to it, the very high rates of unemployment.
Well, I want to thank the caller again. We have just about now 5 minutes, and I have one other caller I want to try to get in, and this is someone who's listening in Champaign. So we will go there, line one. Hello.
Hi. A quick comment before I get to my question, if you don't mind. It seems to me one of the problems with the Elkin thesis is that when you had discrimination actually codified in law, and in my view much more oppressive with regard to the way the society treated black families, you had far less fragmentation in the black family. So it seems to me a very weak argument. We're seeing far more dislocations in current black families than there were in the post-slavery era. So I kind of reject that notion that somehow black families coming out of slavery were so incapacitated that they could not function, as you point that out in some of the comments you made. But as an African-American, I am just astonished that people still advance that as a logical thesis for what's going on today. Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with you. As I said, Moynihan was mistaken to place much faith in Elkins' thesis. What made it attractive to some liberals and to Moynihan in the early 60s was its total indictment of slavery. Mm. And if you keep in mind that up until the 50s, generally speaking, most historians writing, and Elkins was an historian, writing about the history of American or Western hemispheric slavery, or for that matter, slavery out of Africa, had stressed the kind of plantation, mint julep, mammy sort of gone with the wind version of slavery, that it was a sort of benign institution in which white people took care of their slaves. And so Elkins was at pains to say, hey, that's totally, totally wrong. And in so doing, he went overboard.
Right, right. Here's my quick question. It seems to me, Dr. Patterson, that the correlation between being born to a single parent and socioeconomic outcomes are so clear. And in fact, you've seen the same kind of statistical information with regard to white families as there's more and more kids being born out of wedlock. I'm curious as to why you think there's so few black intellectuals. I think of people like Sowell and Shelby Steele, who are actually saying that that is a core reason for why we're seeing the inequities in terms of socioeconomic status between black families and others. I hear very little from black intellectuals with regard to the particular information that statistic shows, that as increasingly more and more of these kids, now 70% from what I understand.
No, you're right. In my last chapter, I mean, the subtitle of the book says this is a story which goes from LBJ to Obama, and I point out that Obama made some efforts, most notably on Father's Day speech in 2008, when he basically rapped black fathers for abandoning their children and so forth and so on. He said that parenthood does not stop at conception. And when he did this, Jesse Jackson, who was a few days later sitting in a studio and didn't know he was going to be overheard or put on the air, said he'd like to cut Obama's nuts off. People like Jesse Jackson are, I think, the kind of people you're talking about. They don't really want to say that there's anything that black people themselves should be blamed for, or that there's anything that black people really can do very much about it. That it's, all the problem comes from white racism and discrimination. So you're right. You do not hear a lot of people talking about that. It is a difficult subject to talk about, as you can well imagine, and not something that many black intellectuals want to touch.
We just have a minute or so just to get to return to Mr. Moynihan and at least early on how he thought about this, perhaps also how President Johnson thought about this. They did seem, while many people were very pessimistic about being able to do anything about the problems that we've been talking about, it does seem, again, at least early on, that both President Johnson and Mr. Moynihan and maybe other people in the administration felt that these problems could actually be solved. It was just a matter of figuring out what to do.
Yes. One of the things that Moynihan got criticized for, as you know, is really not saying what he would do.
Right, right. Uh-huh.
People said, well, you've said all these bad things about us, but you haven't said what to do. But I rather like the way he handled that, because he honestly didn't know. He was aware that what he said many times, this is an interrelated thing involving racism, bad schools, changes in the industrial structure of the country, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the government just shouldn't plunge right in and pass a zillion-dollar appropriation and throw money around.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't put it that way, but he wanted this conference, and he wanted people to seriously study it. He thought the real answer would be for a huge governmental jobs program. He was concerned above all else about unemployment among young black men. And later, he really got slammed by feminists because he didn't say much about the problems of black women. Quite the contrary, he said they were doing better, as they were and as they are now, than black men. But you've got to remember that in 1965, this was a pre-feminist era, and it was widely accepted in a culture that the man's job was to be the breadwinner, and the woman's job was to be the housekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
So he was really anxious to get young black people jobs. We haven't time to go into this now, I know, but this is a lot easier than it sounds. A lot easier than it is. creating huge jobs programs are not only enormously expensive, but some of them involve skills that blacks don't have. I don't just mean physical skills. I mean, you know, social and intellectual skills. They are very expensive. Some of them just waste money. Is this the answer? And while it might help a certain number of young black men, what about the women with the children? What are you going to do about them? I mean, it's a multifaceted, was then and is now problem.
We're going to have to...
Also favored family allowances, such as existed in Europe, which the British government is just right now doing away with, whereby money goes from the federal government to the woman of the family. It's in her name. If she has children, whether or not she's poor, whether or not she's married. So these were and are benefits which are without stigma, without bureaucratic problems. It's like the IRS. Everybody does it. Everybody gets it.
We're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say, we're here at the end of the time, and I'll just have to say to people who are listening, if you'd like to read more, look for the book Freedom Is Not Enough by our guest James T. Patterson. He's the Ford Foundation Professor of History Emeritus at Brown University. And Professor Patterson, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.